Welcome to the ShadowNet. My name's Phil, aka Xeroth Maxima. Threat level alpha. You can't spell scoops without poops. My extra special guest today. He knows he can concede at any time. So let's see if he scoops. It's Eric Kielbeck.
Like, I feel like a lot of the time I understand. Like, do you think I concede a lot?
I think you're the kind of player that if you don't get ahead at first, you'll just be like, it's done, move on to the next one. Use that brain power.
No, I mean, I think it's important to learn how to play from behind. I do concede if I think, like, the game's over, but it's going to take, like, five. Like, if I, in my mind palace, have won, but the game takes five more turns to play out, it's like, you just give them the concede. Because when JNet win rate doesn't matter.
Oh, on JNet, sure, yeah. In a tournament setting, though, you're not like, haha, I've solved this in my head. It's not even worth laying out.
only when I ID. Oh,
okay. Bonus guest this week, the mad scientist who doesn't actually know how anything works. It's Nisei lead dev June Cuervo. No, let me do that stronger. Sorry, June Cuervo.
Hey. Not the lead dev.
Oh shit!
I'm game designer.
Let's redo it from the top. Oh, it's Eric Kielbeck. The mad scientist who doesn't actually know how anything works. It's Nisei lead design. No. No, I had it right. Fuck.
Yeah, you had it right. Lead designer.
This is all staying in.
This is all staying in. The mad scientist who doesn't actually know how anything works. It's Nisei lead designer, June Cuervo.
Yeah. Hey, how's it going, folks?
Hey.
Really
it's
good.
It's crazy that we're here because it's like, it feels like many, many, many moons ago you were like, hey, I remember we were doing the Gateway Scoops episode and we had Zoe come on. At the time, you were like, oh, because I think you did slums. I think you did like a slums cast episode or something around that time.
I wouldn't know.
Or something like that. I don't watch the slums. I don't listen to slums class, so I wouldn't know. But you basically said to us like, "Hey, I'll come on when Boyalis scoops." And like 5 years later,
it's finally
we're here. Yeah.
It was not 5 years. It was two, right?
It was two. Yeah.
Wait, when did Gateway come out?
I think Gateway's like a year and a half. No, it's even 3 months, right?
Because
it was much.
Yeah. So it's not that long. I mean, the pandemic things feel like time has really lost a lot of meaning. So it's hard for me to say if it feels longer or shorter than that. But yeah, I remember that. And I was really looking forward to it at the time.
You're not looking forward to it now.
I've talked to you both for 5 minutes ahead of this. And I'm like, why did I fucking do this?
Yeah, that's what most of my guests say. That's what most of my guests say. Yeah, it's Midnight Sun. Do you know why it's called Midnight Sun, Phil? I actually didn't know this.
I'll tell you why. Because someone had the bright idea to be like, oh, it's Borealis of the Borealis cycle. And then someone thought, no, that's a bad idea. This is very confusing, like a lot of our other naming schemes. So let's come up with a better name. And they came up with Midnight Sun, which is quite a good name.
I mean, I thought it's so Midnight Sun's supposed to take place in like the Arctic or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it because in the Arctic, the sun comes out at midnight?
That's completely untrue. It just doesn't go down in the summertime.
But that means it's possible to have a midnight sun.
Yeah, but it doesn't like pop up at midnight and be like, what's up? It's just still there.
Sure. But that's why it's called Midnight Sun, because it's possible to have a midnight sun in the Arctic.
Correct. Especially in the future. I don't know.
Does that mean that we've had Netrunner cards that are on every continent now? Like in flavor?
If you count all the FFG cards, I think that's pretty much all of them. Although
Australia, have we had Australia? There's Boomerang. Boomerang's clearly in Australia.
Yeah, Boomerang, the hardware was manufactured in Australia, so I guess technically there's a card from Australia, but yeah. That's in the lore, by the way.
That's perfect. And the Arctic, I've never really understood this. The Arctic is not a continent, but Antarctica is a continent.
Absolutely correct. There's no dirt under the North Pole. So, like, Santa's on thin ice in this set. I don't know if Santa's been spoiled yet, so maybe let's keep that under wraps.
Wait, does the Arctic really not have any dirt? Or the Antarctic? Or the North Pole?
The Antarctic is a piece of land underneath all that ice, but the Arctic is just water. It's just cold water, which is ice.
I feel like I learned something today at the age of 33.
I don't know why you would believe me. I don't believe myself. I could be wrong or right. Phil just said it, so I'm just saying what
I just can't believe the lack of research that's gone into the set.
Nothing to do with the theming of the cards. I have a card in the set that I named Cyberdex McStabby, and I think it was a great name.
When designing, was there like, this is kind of a theme for the set? It's probably bullshit, like Cyberdex McStabby, but was there an overarching like shitpost that you wanted to convey that then, you know, the lore team stripped out and murdered?
There always is, yeah. I think the big one for Shaper in the set is I wanted the number 10 to appear as many times as possible. So like a lot of the designs of the set, like Deep Dive originally saw 10.
Yeah.
No, it definitely needs LOL. But yeah, and then like I think the endurance cost 10, and like there's a bunch of stuff. Like there is a program in this is a future scoop. I think there's a program in Parhelion that costs 10. Ooh. I think that one actually does cost 10. But the like Shaper's number being the number 10 was something that that was like a major shitpost of the set, and then that got developed out because 10 is like an unbalanceable number in like the majority of cases.
It's rather large.
Yes, but from a theme perspective, I stuck pretty close to the world document that former Nisei narrative people had worked on.
So you're the lead designer on this set. Do you how many people on your team?
Oh God, I don't want to miscount. One, two. Shit. Including me, 5.
Do you all sort of like take a flight paid for by Nisei and go to like a sweat lodge and then just sit in the sweat lodge and come up with the set in a week? Or I guess like one of the things I'm always kind of curious is because, you know, by the end of the set, there's a lot of coherence and the ideas really crystallize. And a lot of that's dev, but also it's like design having like a sort of set of ideas at the beginning. When you and your team start the process, is it y'all just like sort of sitting around and being like, yo, this would be fucking sick if this is a Netrunner card? Or are you like, oh, okay, we have an idea, we want Anarch to like do X, and so we're gonna come up with a bunch of ideas around X?
It's definitely both. As you know, like Revolver has the subtype weapon because we were like, Revolver's so sick, we gotta make more weapons. And then now there's like more weapon cards that aren't out yet in files, right? Because it's just like, that's so fucking cool. We got to get more weapons in the game. So like, sometimes it's like that. Like sometimes it's just like a single card is like enough to inspire a lot of different design work as a result of that single card. Mm-hmm. But the real way that the set gets designed is we start with like basically a rough idea of the story and the setting. So for Borealis, you know, we had the Arctic, and then we had some plot beats and things like that to work with. We had some like outlines for where the different factions were and what kinds of products they made or why they ran, or like a little bit about their backstory. Usually it's like their ethnicity, their gender, a little bit about like where they're from and like what they're trying to do. So they have like a kind of motivation. And then we take that and we're kind of like, usually we start with like the IDs, because the IDs are kind of the basis for like, I think of IDs in Netrunner as like commons or something, like in a collectible game. They're like the part of the game that is like, they teach you the most about the mechanics and themes of the set because you see them right away and early.
Yeah. It's like they set the rhythm.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I mean, to call them commons makes them sound really lame, but like they're just binder fodder. But no, joking aside, it's like the theme of the set is what comes first. There's like a little bit of the narrative flavor and then the mechanical flavor. For Borealis, it was a really big thing I brought into Nisei when I started working on it, where it was like, no more fucking around with cards that just do stuff that other Netrunner cards do. We got to make new shit that like really like feels groundbreaking. Yeah. I just was pulling my hair out being like, we just got to stop spinning our wheels and like take risks and like try crazy things. And like, Borealis was like, in a lot of ways, my attempt to get the design team at Nisei and Nisei as an organization thinking about the future of the game and what Netrunner looks like in 3 releases, 4 releases, 5 releases. And I think while Ashes was an awesome set in a lot of ways, I think if every set was just Ashes, I don't know that we would be evolving Netrunner past the Android days. It would be kind of stuck in the past.
I think like one of the things I feel about Ashes always is Ashes is a very comfortable set. And it kind of had to be, I think, because I think in some ways, if BoyOS had been in the first Netrunner set, there wouldn't have been as much buy-in. Because people would have just been like, what the fuck is this shit? This isn't Netrunner.
It's like too crazy.
It's too crazy. But I think like, and so Ashes in some ways is looks like a lot like an FFG set. And I think there's intent there. You know, like it's meant to sort of be something that's always familiar, like we've seen some of these before. I think in Borealis, one of the things that is really new, and while it's sort of been a thing, in like currents are kind of like a keyword, but not really, and you have lockdowns from Ashes. This is the first time in a Netrunner set that we've ever had like straight up keyworded mechanics, like from a game like Magic or Hearthstone or Flesh and Blood. Like those are all games that use keyworded mechanics. It's really, really common. So I'm just curious as to like why you decided to go with keyworded mechanics like Sabotage or Charge, and was there any trepidation of like, oh, are we breaking too far out of the mold?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely some internal buy-in that needed to happen. I got a lot of DMs from just people being like, I think people might hate this. This might be something that pisses people off, right? And I, you know, I'm like, that's okay. Whenever I make a decision about a set, I'm not really looking for, you know, universal buy-in per se. And I think the fact that some people were really excited about the direction and some people were a little nervous or down on it was a good sign to pursue it and see how it fits into Netrunner. So there was internal trepidation, some internal selling of the idea I had to do. But I would say, which is a part of any design process, by the way, whenever I'm doing anything in Netrunner, I have to kind of sell it to the organization because the design of the game starts in a lot of ways. I have to pitch it, make sure that, you know, we're all on the same side and defending that decision, first step of making something new in Netrunner. So yeah, that was definitely a part of it. But I will also say that the decision itself is very basic, at least in my mind, which is keywords are a piece of game design technology. They're not, I don't know, like, it's not like a totally new game because you have keywords in it. Like, tons of board games have keywords. Like, keywords are just, like, a thing that games have sometimes because they have useful features. And it really isn't, like, characteristically defining of a game whether or not it has keywords. In fact, I would say Android is very barbaric in a sense that it's not willing to keyword more mechanics because it's not taking advantage of modern game design technology. So, you know, in the lexicon of modern games, we use keywords all the time as designers for all kinds of things. So in my mind, it's just kind of catching up Netrunner and modernizing it more than it is really changing anything about the way that it was being designed previously, because the keywords, right, like what do they do? Like, what's the difference between writing charge in a card and writing add a power counter to a card that has at least a power counter on it over and over and over and over again? Well, it's thematic. The word charge is a word that players will use, and it's an action that we ask you to take a lot of times when you're playing Shaper cards in Borealis. So if we're going to make you take an action a lot of times, we should like give you a word for it so that you know what to call it, so that there's some kind of clear guidance from us that this is like a major theme. Because we put charge in the identity, this kind of goes back to the identities being the commons. Because charge is on the identity, you know it's going to be a big theme in the set. Like, you can expect lots of cards from every faction with power counters because we're calling out power counters through the mechanic. So we have like the narrative and in-game purpose. We have the mechanical purpose. We have the rule simplification purpose, which is like, you know, not every card has to have italics under charge. Like, once you've seen it a few times, we can just write the word charge and we'll kind of know you know what to do. So, yeah, there's just like, when you think about what a keyword is, a lot of the time, really what it is it's a like thematic grounding pole that you like put in the ground, or a mechanical grounding pole. It's like you plant your flag and then you build the set around the keyword. And I think it's a good way of just signaling what a faction is like about, you know, in a set.
Yeah, and I don't think it's like untrodden ground in Netrunner, right? We've had like, you know, even from the start, you had meat damage versus net damage. While not really the same as like a mechanical keyword, it's still something you have to keep track of that affects other things. So I don't think it's like completely out there for this game. Like,
no, I agree.
I just want to go back to something else you said. Clearly, you feed off the hate from the haters. Do you ever get like too high on that?
Only when white play does it.
I like sometimes, some like the problem with June is that June is the most confident person I know. And she will just, like, say something about Netrunner, and, like, I'll be like, okay, I know in my heart of hearts this is not true, but I really have to think about it because June said it.
Yeah.
And June will just be like, oh, yeah, that's, like, some random thing I just said. I don't even remember saying that. All the time. It's so tilting.
I'm sorry. I would like to take this moment to publicly apologize for gaslighting Eric repeatedly in playtest calls.
That's actually not allowed on the show. We stand by our bad takes here. So, I mean, no. It's ShadowNet endorsed gaslighting Eric.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, for real, though. It's like my Netrunner, my knowledge, like, as a Netrunner player versus as a game designer overlap in pretty weird ways. And one of those ways is, like, I kind of try to, like, will my version of Netrunner I have into my head into existence by, like, saying things about what we're trying to do confidently to the team and to playtesters, so that even if in Eric's mind it's like, yeah, that's not how that works, like, it's no, wrong, at least there's, like, a really concrete idea of, like, where we're going and what we're trying to do to people, so they can kind of compare what's real against what the direction is, if that makes sense. So that's like kind of the value in being confident. I don't know.
I mean, you also said, like, you need like so much buy-in for stuff. I mean, confidence obviously helps a bit more with that than being like, oh, I don't know if we should do this.
I mean, I just remember in playtest when they announced they were doing these guys could do mechanics. I was like, that's a bad idea. Like, I actually thought it was a bad, because I was like, that's not what Netrunner is. Like, it's not how Netrunner works. And June basically laid out this argument of, like, and you know, of like, we're going to do this thing, and here's the reason why we think it's good. And, like, you know, if you don't think it's good, that sucks to suck, but, like, this is what we're doing, so I hope you want to play some playtest games. And I played with the mechanics, and it was like, oh, actually, this is really good. I have a question for you about the mechanics. One of the things, at least about Midnight Sun, is that there's no mechanics on the corp cards.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious as to why was the but all of the runner factions have mechanics, whether it's like keywords, whether it's sabotage, mark, or charge. Obviously, there was a conscious decision there. Why did the design team decide to put keywords on the runner cards and no keywords on the corp cards? And will we see any keywords on the corp cards in the second set?
So there are no keyword mechanics specifically for the corps in the entire Borealis cycle. The reasoning why we started with the runners was because, and this is my opinion, this might be an opinion that Eric feels gaslit by, and that's fine. I think the corp side of the game is in the greatest state of disrepair relative to the runner side in terms of what it needs to feel like it has fulfilling and compelling gameplay.
No, I think that's just true. I think that's very true.
Okay, fair. So, like, the corp side of the game, I feel like it lacks win conditions. It lacks diversity of win conditions. It lacks proactivity across its entire card pool. It feels oftentimes like you're not controlling the game you want to when you play corp. You feel like corp is like a lot more like reactive and reliant on mistakes than I'd really like it to be. And I think overall, like, all that together meant that what we wanted for Borealis was to do some, and but by contrast, the runner side of the game is pretty cool. Like, the factions have decks, they have cards, there's like lots of fun stuff you can do. Runner gameplay feels pretty good. There's ice and icebreakers and cool events. Like, yeah, you're playing runner. Like, it's like, that is successful, I feel like, in terms of like the standard card pool pre-Gateway, because Gateway wasn't out when we were designing Borealis. But by contrast, the corps, when you compare corps to the days of, you know, Fastro NEH and RP and like some of the, and like HB Food Coats and some of maybe the more like staple corp decks from the history of Netrunner, it really feels like corps are kind of a shell of their former self in terms of what they can do in a game of Netrunner. So what we wanted to do is, instead of diluting that potentially by adding new keywords for the corps or new mechanics for the corps, we wanted to take the base game of the corps, build off of what was in Gateway really explicitly, and try to sort of introduce some powerful corp win conditions and powerful corp tools so that it felt like playing corp had a kind of like, had that same like cohesion and excitement that it did in the past, and also so that it was sort of, you know, as intellectually simulating, as interesting as playing the runner side, which I felt like at the time we were testing Borealis, that it kind of wasn't in standard.
I think also, I mean, to me, it's like the one, I think when this is one of, I'm a big fan of the Boreal cycle as a whole, and I really love Midnight Sun. The problems with the core gameplay that I think you're right about is that one of the only accesses of play right now is money for the core. It's like, it's, I think it's one of the reasons why PD is so good. It's just because PD just makes money very efficiently and out-tempos the runner. And like, that's fine, and it's a valid style of gameplay. But it's like, yeah, there's like just nothing else besides like, oh, is your like economy more efficient? There's no, there's nothing divergent. There's no really big fast advance deck. It's like, even for periods of the game, like in 2016, 2017, you had deck, like they were messed up, but you had decks like Scorpios, which was like completely divergent to like the idea of like economy being the centerpiece of the game. And so I think printing win conditions, the win conditions are printed in Midnight Sun and Borealis. I mean, I think it's going to help the corp a lot, and it's going to make the game more than most sets, I think, feel fresh, because I think what you're getting out of this set, at least on the corp side, is like, it's not just new toys. It's like new different ways to think about deck building and think about winning the game. Like it recontextualizes old cards. Cause it's like, oh, now I can win the game this way. It's not just about money.
I really like that, because this whole discussion about like, oh, the corps are stale, you know, they need new win conditions. It reminds me of like when the Flashpoint cycle came out, is like, oh, now the corps get to be new and edgy and there's no more rules, which maybe sort of happened the Flashpoint cycle, but the runners got some pretty crazy shit too. Do you think that's an inevitable cycle in game design, that you know, you go too far one way and then you have to compensate on the other side? Or is this, obviously you are shooting for this happy medium?
All game design requires risks is the short answer to your question. So it's just, you have to take risks to go in the direction you want to go. And some of those risks involve requiring an overcorrection. The idea is that every time you take a risk, you learn a meaningful thing about how the game is designed, and then you can take that into the next risk you take. So like, each risk sort of improves in your, in how many standard deviations away you are of getting the desired result you want, right? So it's very much the case of like, yeah, like maybe we overshoot it with the corpse, maybe giving everyone a bunch of 3/2s and 2/1s and like a fast advance tools and like traps and like, you know, maybe Pravados Consulting and Vladimir City Grid is just like really stupid. And like, you know, that's fine. Like, it's okay if like we mess something up. The expectation shouldn't really be perfection. I think what players want is interesting gameplay that has some novelty to it, that has good replayability. And in order to do that, you have to take some chances. So it's okay if we overcorrect. Totally fine. And in fact, if no cards get banned in Borealis and it's just kind of like this really perfectly balanced thing that like has no problems and people feel like it was a good 6 out of 10, I kind of feel like that was a failure on our part if that happens, you know? And to be clear, it won't. Like, this set has some fire, so something will go down with it, which is cool. I'm excited to see what breaks.
Pravados Consulting is such a fucked idea. When we signed off on that one in playtesting, I'm still like, man, I don't know, it's fucked. The fact that you get to put, like, so if you have a trap out, if you have like a Yotica Cypher or whatever, you get to put the advancement counter on after they commit to access.
Yeah.
Like, that's fucked up.
Yeah, it's pretty cool with a Cerebral Overrider.
You better check it early, right?
This is kind of like what I mean. It's like, oh, what's a win condition for the corp? It's like, let's add texture to what unadvanced cards are. That's neat. Like, that is a way to make gameplay different, right? So Pravados Consulting does that.
And I love it. It's like, now you can make shitty Puppet Master decks without having a score Puppet Master. It's awesome.
That was the inspiration for Brett. Of course, it's the same. It's the exact same text. It's also the only card in the entire set of Borealis where the design version of the file in the prototype that we submitted to dev is identical to the one we're printing. No changes.
Yeah. It's really cool. It's a great idea. We got cards to spoil, which honestly, Phil, going into spoiler season, give me, like, did you think we were going to get scoops?
I knew we were going to get scoops. Like, come on, we're a big deal now. After more than a year of doing this, people know who we are. You think Nisei would dare to, like, not give us scoops? There would be riots in the street.
That's fair. That's fair. It would have been a public relations scandal. Exactly. It would have been another letter. It would have been awful. We got 4 Wayland cards, including my champion card, because I actually won a tournament 2 years ago. I won APAC 2020? I don't remember that far back.
Were you with Wayland? That's the one question.
Sorry?
Did you play Wayland? Did you win with Wayland?
Yeah, actually, I did. That was the meta where like I was like, corpse or ass, I'm just going to play Titan.
Mm.
And we played Titan and Freedom. Yeah, so most of these cards synergize with Orb, which is the Wayland ID from Midnight Sun. I'm just going to read its card text just so we're all on the same page about what it's due. So when we talk about these cards. So Orb basically says, whenever you trash a res card, except during installation, you may search R&D for one card with a printed res cost exactly one less than the trash cost printed res cost. So the one less than the card you trashed. Install and res the card you found, ignoring credit costs. Use this ability only once per turn. So
this is so cool to me. This is so cool. Like, Jemison's rotating out with...
That's not true, by the way. But sure.
Isn't it?
No, it is not. Oh, damn. It's Titan, Gagarin, and Argus.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, see you later, Argus. Anyways, I love this idea of, like, escalating your tempo by, like... I mean, Jemison's case, like, getting rid of agendas, but this, trashing your cards, that is so cool to me.
It's like, it's kind of like, there's a card from Magic the Gathering, which is very famous, called Birthing Pod.
Gross.
Which allowed you to pay mana to sacrifice creatures, and then you could search your deck for a creature of one converted mana cost higher. Okay. Turns out searching for one higher is really fucked up, but searching for one less is still quite good.
And rezzing, so, like, yeah, this is very good.
Yeah, the card you're getting is free, basically. You have to pay additional costs, so you can't use this to get Archer. You just ignore the credit cost of installation and paying for it. But if you trash like a 5-cost card, you can go get like a border control for free and put it on anywhere you want.
Yeah, that's excellent.
So let's start.
You still pay the install costs, so I mean,
no, you don't. Install and res the card you found, ignoring credit costs.
Oh yeah, there you go. Install. Oh, cool.
Do you want to? Which one of these cards? Do you want to? How about I'll do my card and Stevica, and you do Envelopment and Extract.
Sounds good. Okay, start with your card. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this
is
my card.
Bring us back to the far past of 2020.
So we luck-sacked our way into Top Cut with Titan. It was lovely. I won, and I think the next day I messaged June and was like, hey, I get to make a champ card. And this was like just when Boyaz, I think, was just about to like enter playtesting. So June was like, if you can get me the playtest card in like a week or something, like we'll put it in the set. And I've been thinking about Wayland ideas. I think about Wayland cards. And one of the sort of sub themes I really like about Wayland thematically is this idea that like they will burn their own house down just to like catch you with the flames.
Mm-hmm.
Like this idea of like no cost. Like they always get payback. Like no cost is too high. And I really like this idea of like trashing your cards for benefit. And so like I didn't know that the ID was Orb at the time, but I wanted to build this card that like you trash your own cards and you got this big benefit. And also, I wanted a win condition. I wanted like a flashy. I wanted a way for like corpse to win the game. I wanted a way for acid spam corpse to win the game because acid spam is probably my favorite archetype. And I was like, acid spam has this like really. I don't think it's like inherently problematic. I think the problematic part of acid spam is when the games go on for like 50 minutes because the acid spam deck doesn't actually have a way to win the game.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, I want this card where it's like, okay, you get like 15 assets and then the game ends, like you get paid out and it just like shortcuts the game. And I think June really liked that, and I was a big fan of that. So my card's called Mutually Assured Destruction. It's a 4-cost Wayland operation with 4 influence, and it's a triple. As an additional cost to play the operation, spend 2 clicks. Trash any number of your rezzed cards. Give the runner 1 tag for each card trashed this way.
June, Eric claims you really like this. Is that true?
Yeah, totally. I like everything about this card, because I think it fulfills like multiple player fantasies, both the Wayland fantasy of, as Eric said, like burning your own house down. It's also a punchy win condition. It has combo potential. It works in a variety of strategies, not just asset spam, which I think is very cool. It also has the kind of corner case of just like, well, whatever, I have some high profile target equivalent or scorched earth equivalent in my hand. I'm just going to blow my board up and give you 1 turn to win. And if you can't win, you're dead. And I think that all those elements combined make it what I think is like a really strong Netrunner card. And I think a very strong champ card in general. Like when people come to a champ card and they're like, I want a piece of ice. I'm like, let's make like a sweet operation or a connection. You know, like let's do something kind of sick and spicy. Let's not like Like, you want a res swordsman? Like, I don't, not really. Like, let's spice it up. You know, like
putting Rotom on blast here.
Yeah. Well, not really. I just think it's like my, and I didn't design that card with Rotom, so I don't know. But when people come to me design cards, I really like when they come to me with like a player story, and Eric had a really clear story for what kind of card, you know, he wanted to design. So it was like, that is really easy for me as a designer to work with somebody, because it's like, there was a gameplay objective and a narrative objective, and they met really nicely. And I think we designed this card in like 20 minutes, like in the tech, and then we're just like, ship it. It's in the file.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It was just like, it was one of those things where I was just like, oh, I want to do this trashing thing. I want a win condition fastest ban, because like, I think something June had said about Netrunner that I really resonated with. And like, I think is like a really strong and coherent defense of archetypes that are maybe not seen as fun by the community, where it's like, she basically said, listen, problem with like asset spam or like even maybe attrition strategies isn't that they're inherently like wrong or players should feel bad for playing them. The problem is the games take really long, and the games are like over, but then play out for like 10 more turns. And like, I've played a lot of Gagarin Prison, and I know that like, that's just true. You win the game, and then the game has to go on for 10 more turns. And so one of the things June has said internally about the game often is like, we're looking for ways for players just end the game. Like, they win and the game ends and you move to the next game. And I felt like with Mutually Assured Destruction, I wanted a way for asset spam to be like, hey, I got 15 assets, you can't win. And also you have 10 tags, the game's over because I'm going to kill you. It's important to note that high profile targets could be banned when this card comes out. So one of the first things with the card was like, I remember one of the first discussions internally about the card was, should this be terminal? And I really resisted it being terminal because I wanted it to be an open-ended combo kill card, where it's clear that it's not great at being a combo kill card because it's a triple, but I wanted to leave the open space for like players who really want to do that. Like, for example, Boom is going to be in the card pool for the next set once Midnight Sun releases. So in theory, if your hand is Biotic, Boom, and a Mutually Assured Destruction, and you have two rezzed cards, and the runner has no way to dodge the damage or the tags, they're dead.
And you have like, and they don't, 16 credits or something, yeah.
It's not good, it's not consistent, but Pincel killed me with it like 3 times in playtesting.
Yeah.
You know, and another combo is to use MCA Austerity Policy to get the extra clicks, and then to Boom plus Mutual Assured Destruction.
Love it.
So I'm happy with it. I think that it's one of those like sort of open-ended power cards, I'm hoping, that just like floats around for a while. I think June's right in the sense that there's just like a lot of different strategies it fits into, because it's like, it's really high cost when you think about it. Like, trashing your own cards is a high cost, and they have to, it's a triple, but giving the runner tags without them running is also a very high reward.
Yeah.
And I like those kinds of cards, at least on the corp side of Netrunner, because it feels like if you build your deck to exploit Mutually Assured Destruction, you're going to get paid out.
What's the most amount of tags you've gotten off this baby?
12.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
Was that like to get out of misdirection range? Like, what the hell?
Yeah, so it's because they had like 8 credits in misdirection out.
So you had to like go all of it. You had to burn it off.
it was really good. But yeah, I really love it. I'm so happy with the artwork too. It's really, it like honestly, like,
did
I've been
you
playing
consult on it?
I actually have I did a photo of like me posing in a suit and like sort of like to get general vibes, and I knew what I wanted it to be. Like, I knew thematically what I wanted the card to be. I wanted this to be this idea of like something's bad's happening in like Wayland HQ, and like this is like the retaliation. That's how I see the card thematically, right? It's like, okay, like if you're gonna hurt us, like we're gonna hurt ourselves just to fucking hurt you. It's like burning your house and catching the flames thing. And so yeah, we did the art, and I was like, I want my hand to be on a big red button.
So you did force the meme potential in there. Great, yeah.
Yeah, it's we wanted a meme. And also, like I've been playing Netrunner for 10 years now. And so it's like, it's crazy because this game has been such a big part of my life. It's very surreal to see myself on a card and to be like, oh, there's just going to be people all over the world who are going to fucking lose to Mutually Assured Destruction. And be salty, and my name's gonna be on the card, and that's sick.
I love that.
Awesome. Is that Grundle in the background? Does that?
Yeah, we got some Easter eggs. We got tricks out here. I really like to imagine that this card is taking place during the events of Monster Slayer, which is one of the novellas.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really good art. I really love the artwork. As is tradition, I will have to change my profile picture to my Netrunner incarnation now.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, in Aub, this card's interesting. Like, I think what June said about, oh, you just like trash all of your cards and you give one turn to win. This allows you to like forfeit all your ice, and then you can tutor for one ice and put it on like the server where you think the agenda is, and then win the game.
Mm.
So I think this might actually get played as an Aub as like a win condition, because this is like a way to trash your cards. You only get one Aub trigger, so you only be able to tutor for one thing, but like it's still pretty decent.
That's so cool. So I'm still just looking at the art. Oh, that's great. Shall we move on to another card?
Do you want to do one of yours?
I honestly don't remember which one you told me to do. Can I do Stavka?
Yeah, sure.
I like this one. Stavka, which who knows if I'm pronouncing that right. It's nice. Sentry, Destroyer, shooting some rigs out there. When you res this ice, you may trash one of your other installed cards and, you know, maybe trigger ID with that. If you do, this ice gets +5 strength for the remainder of the run. Two subs that trash one installed program each cost 4. That's pretty good. 2 influence, 2 strength. 2 strength is a little low. And, oh, man.
Well,
let's
7.
Just start with the
it's
art.
7.
Undeniably Scott's work here. Lovely.
Oh, the train. Oh, is this a train or
tank? I don't know. I thought it was.
I like it.
Oh, it's got like little it. Pinchy things? June, what's going on?
I like
on?
It. It could be construction equipment.
Mm. I actually have no idea what it is. You're asking the wrong person. You got to get Morgan in for
it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll rope Morgan in. We could get Scott on, I betcha.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, but.
So this is not really 2 strength. It's going to be 7, right? 7's a fuck lot of strength.
That's a lot. I mean, and Rig Shooter hasn't really been in the public consciousness. Like, you have some people trying in startup with retribution baseball bats here and there, but it's not as effective as, like, the Scorpios meta, right? Where it was, like, actually terrifying. I think this gives it a lot of legs.
This is, like, I mean, this is just, I feel like you're gonna, this is really, like, it's interesting because, so the card you trash doesn't have to be rezzed.
Mm,
so let's, right. If you have a dead piece of ice on archives or like a dead asset or something, you can just turn it into +5 strength.
Yep.
And like a lot of runners, like 7's a lot of strength.
Especially for 4 credits. Like 4 credits, you think like, oh, you know, they might res like a whoredom, like, oh, big deal, a border control or something. But like, you don't expect a beefy Stavka like this until now.
I mean, I think it's sort of like in the same. One of the reasons I like this ice is it's sort of in the same world as Ping.
Mm.
Where it's like Ping makes the game more dynamic because it makes individual runs matter more. If that makes sense. Because now it's like, oh, there's not only is this decision of like, am I going to res this ice? But like, when I res this ice, am I going to do the trigger? Like, when's the best time to res this ice? Because it feels like if you're the court player and you time the Stavka, it can be just
absolutely crushing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a big design goal. And in terms of like what ice are about, historically, what designers have done in Netrunner is make really complicated ice subroutines, which amounts to a math problem and wasted text because they don't fire, right? Or when they do fire, it's just like everyone's like, what does this do again? And you have to like read it. I've played in like round 8 of a Swiss and someone had to like read my ice because it just never fires. And they're like, wait, what does it do again now that it's firing? I usually just pay 6 for this or whatever. So it's like, these kinds of things, I think, are kind of bad gameplay. And so, like, a lot of the idea with Borealis and Gateway, cards like Ping, cards like Stavka, the idea is that, like, you know, the player who's rezzing the ice has a really interesting decision, but also the interesting part of the card is, you know, not nestled away in the part of the card that will never happen. Like, the interesting part of Stavka happens when you rez it and when you choose to rez it, and then past that point, it's a very simple piece of ice that costs 2 credits to break in most cases, but that's very much by design.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I mean, I think it's going to be, it's interesting, because Ballista's 5 to res or 4 to res? I don't know. Phil, how much is Ballista?
I think it's 5.
Ballista's 5? Jesus fucking Christ. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's unfortunate for Ballista.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's decent, right? It gives you options, but this is much more threatening in a lot of ways, right? Especially two programs. Like one program, you could probably get it back. Two is twice as bad, some could say.
That's math. That's ShadowNet math, baby. I think five, like four to res, like in the early game, you're not going to take the trigger maybe because you just want trash programs. But in the late game, this has some spice.
Yeah.
And also it's an ob trigger, which is like, this is so interesting. Like you have an ice wall res, you can use this to tutor for Rashida.
Oh, yeah. Damn, tutor for Rashida. Oh my God. That's dangerous. Yeah. And I like it too, because after it becomes the big boy, it becomes a smaller one. And then maybe you do want to trash it later on. You know, it's not quite as effective.
Yeah, it's like, I also think like one of the things, if we think about the ob decks, it's really going to be, I think ob is like powerful, but also a really interesting deck building challenge. Because you want to build your deck in such a way that you have like essentially like stepping stones between the costs, right?
Mm.
Like when you trash your four, you want to get a three. When you trash your three, you want to get a two. And when you trash your two, you want to get a one. So that like you're always getting value from your ob triggers. And then it's interesting because if you have win conditions at the lower stepping stone, so like let's say for example, when MCA Austerity, Mutual Assured Destruction, Kill Combo deck, maybe we're like, this allows us to tutor for MCA, which is like really important. Maybe we only play one MCA austerity policy because you can tutor for it. Like tutoring is just like, we haven't, like, I love ob because it's like the intermeshing of two Wayland themes, which is like trashing your own cards and tutoring. And it's so lit. And this card allows you to fucking trash programs and tutor for cards, which is just, in my view, nuts. Let's talk about Extract. It's the dump truck card.
Hit me with it. What does the dump truck do?
The dump truck is a three cost Wayland operation. It's a transaction. So building a better world fans, you know, we hear you. It's card text is you gain 6 credits. You may trash one of your installed cards to gain 3 credits. Flavor text is leave nothing of value behind. And it's 2 influence. So if we just play it and we don't do anything, we just play Beanstalk Royalties for 3 credits. It's just, which is value. It's
expensive beans.
Well, and it's harder to grow beans in the Arctic.
Fair.
You know? Do they grow? Can you grow any food in the Arctic?
Like, if you have a greenhouse in the Arctic, yeah, why not?
Well, but Arctic foxes, like, have to eat something.
I think
they polar bears.
All are Arctic creatures, yeah, like mice. Like Arctic mice. But what do the Arctic mice eat?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Arctic bugs?
Arctic bugs. Arctic bugs sounds like an enemy type from, like, Dragon Quest or something.
Yeah, or like a band name.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Anyway.
So this card is probably not great unless you trash one of your installed cards. Because once you trash one of your installed cards, you've essentially clicked for 6, which is better than IPO.
But you have to give up a transaction. So, I mean, you could trash your one blockchain and make your second blockchain not really that much better, but maybe a little bit.
I think this card is an auto 3 of an ob.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like, it's just ob this support. Is just,
proc your ID, the card.
Yeah, because you can trash like a border control. Oh, here's a fun thing with ob. If you trash a border control mid run, you can tutor for a piece of ice mid run or a 3 cost card mid run. But yeah, extract. I mean, it's a kind of a workhorse card. It's not very flashy. I like the artwork in it a lot. I like dump trucks. I had a. Did you have Tonka toys growing up, Phil?
Absolutely, and I have some now. Big fan.
I love Tonka toys so much. I used to play the Tonka toys video game growing up, like with like the truck and everything.
I did not know that was a thing. Holy shit, you're such a zoomer. There's a Tonka video game? What?
Yeah, Tonka toys. Like, I played on, like, a computer in the den. Like, my mom got me Tonka toys.
Did they call the living room a den in Canada?
Yeah, what else?
I guess so. Is that not a thing?
I've never called my living room a den.
There's the living room and there's the den, which is...
No, I didn't have... We called our living room the den.
I think sometimes there's both, which is just... Big house trying to sell you a big
house. No, I don't. We did not have that. I was not blessed with that big house growing up. I had just a living room, but we called it the den growing up.
It's comfy.
It's a Canadian. It's a Canadian thing.
When I think of a den, I think of like a space that has like a den mother, you know, like a caretaker of the space or something.
Like a bear.
That can be accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a den is where some bears live. I guess that makes sense for Canadians.
Exactly.
Yeah, polar bears. I've seen polar bears in real life actually. This guy.
Yeah, I will say about Extract, by the way, before we don't totally lose it, is that one of the things we look for when we're designing like set mechanics and themes is like, can it go on like a basic econ card? Can the basic econ card in the set for the faction like support the theme we're trying to produce And if it can, it's usually a good sign that it's a good mechanic, because it means it has like a lot of utility to be kind of put places. It's kind of like easy to design, right? Because you're like, oh, it's extract. Like, you need to trash a card to get the extra credits. And then it's like, why would you trash a card, you might ask? And then you print, you know, there's ob. So it's like trashing a card. It's an easy thing to put on a card. It's like what is commonly called like a kicker mechanic, right? Like, you get the card, but then you can trash the card to get a bigger effect. And this particular cost of trashing cards was really easy to put a lot of places. And that's kind of like why it shows up on extract too.
I also like this card because it's like, it has the possibility, like, I just know I'm going to fucking play a game on JNet where someone's turn one is going to be like, install an ice in front of HQ, extract it, trashing it. I don't, like, it's funny. It's a funny card, too. Like, it has, like, someone's going to extract a tier or something. It's going to be fucking hilarious.
Yeah, you know, someone just made like $7 because they're building a better world. It's no joke.
Yeah, they're like, this remote ice does not matter. It's like a DNA tracker, and they just blow it up to extract it or something. You know, it's just like, this is done. This doesn't matter anymore. Blow it up. It's like a huge investment. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Yeah, I'm kind of curious if we'll see it outside of OB. I think it's possible. Like, Econ's Econ, and it's really good when you can play Econ.
Yeah. I might see it, like, kill some babysitters, like, just recycle Marilyn. Maybe? I don't know.
I didn't know where you were going with that, and I was a little concerned.
June, you mentioned, like, just tacking on stuff to Econ cards. Is that, like, you start a new set and that's the first thing you do? Like, oh, each faction needs one new Econ? Is that, like, a baseline for a set? Or where does that come from, I guess?
No, yeah, totally. I think what we always do is we make... The first thing we do is every set has to have enough stuff in it that, like, if you own Gateway and just that set, you can play good Netrunner.
So you are catering to startup, is what you're saying.
100%. Oh, does that mean that... Okay, hey, calm down.
Nisei hates standard players. You heard it here first. Startup prioritized over standard players.
Seriously, though, like, standard's great. We have an entire playtesting process that's completely dedicated to standard. We actually don't playtest startup. We don't dedicate playtesting resources to it, because our assumption is that Gateway is such a beautiful, elegant, perfect product with no flaws whatsoever that it will support itself plus another set with absolutely no problems ever.
Exactly. I see no problem, and I've also never played Carnivore, so...
Yep, there you go. So, putting that aside, like, the idea with designing sets is, like, people who play Netrunner, you know, this was really true in my experience when we were at PAX, was people would come up and be like, yeah, Gateway rules. I have Gateway and, like, Ashes, and that's it, and it's so fun. I'm having such a good time. And it's, like, that kind of made us realize, like, Gateway is really fun, and, like, it works kind of as like a board game version of Netrunner, but like, we want every set we make to kind of have the basic tools you need to play some Netrunner alongside Gateway, so that like, when you have Gateway and you buy one more thing from Nisei, you feel like you meaningfully improved your options in every category of the game.
Yeah.
So that is something we try to do with every set. And that's why Borealis is structured the way it is. If you look at it, like, once you see all the cards in Borealis and whenever Parhelion comes out, you'll see that, like, oh yeah, like, every set has like a good spread, every faction has a good spread of ice and an econ card and like a win condition and some agendas that actually do something. So it's like it's like pretty balanced in that way, like, where you feel like you have meaningful tools in every category, which was definitely a design intention.
Cool. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me, because it's like, you know, Borealis isn't just for standard players, Borealis isn't just for startup players, it's for both. And so like, Borealis is, I think, in my view, oriented more so towards standard. It, like June said, it's playtested exclusively in the standard environment, and it's got heaters for standard. But at the same time, I think if Borealis released and you bought it as a new player and you were like, oh, none of these cards make fucking sense, like, I can't combine this with Gateway and do anything, I think it's a failure. And this clear intent that, oh, you get a couple agendas, you get a couple win cons, every faction got some ice, and it all makes sense. I think one of the achievements of Borealis and Midnight Sun is that the cards all make sense internally and as like an internal closed loop system. And they also make sense as cards released in the context of the standard card pool. And Ob and Pravados, I think Pravados has tools in Midnight Sun and in future sets to win the game and set tools in Ashes, but also, you know, Pravdos has a lot of synergy with cards in the standard environment. It makes a lot of sense to me that you're going to do both. Do you want to spoil the last card?
Feel it, yeah. I was just waiting for a little more there, seeing if there was something else. Next up, we have Envelopment Ice, a classic Wayland Barrier. When you res this ice, place 4 power counters on it. When your turn begins, remove 1 hosted power counter. This ice gains a sub and the run before each printed subroutine for each hosted power counter. Sub, trash this ice. So we have another reiteration of a Wayland Color Pie theme we'd seen before, which is stealing the melt mechanic from the Roseville cycle.
So you've caught on to my master plan, which is just coercing CTZ and Brian into making garbage Netrunner cards so I can copy them.
Exactly.
Can we talk about... Can we talk about dice? Or is that not allowed?
We can talk about dice.
Dice is features in the Roseville cycle. I remember we tested dice as a V1 mechanic for criminal.
Yeah, this is actually a cool story if I can tell it.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, it seems gambling.
We're blacklisted crazy anyway, so they can't come after us.
So this is a pretty cool game design lesson. So the mark mechanic originally, I want to say, and you can correct me, Eric, I might be remembering it wrong. The idea was like you roll a d6 and then you consult a chart.
Yep. Exactly. That's exactly it.
So you would say, Sable would say, roll a d6. At the start of your turn, roll a d6. If it's a 1 and 2, you may make a free run on R&D. If it's a 3 to 4, you can make a free run on whatever. Like, it was like you're basically rolling a d6 and looking at a chart, almost like you're playing an RPG, right? Where you'd like roll a d6, see the outcome. And this tied to a lot of cards where you could roll d6 and like they would have a variety of effects. And we prototyped a whole mechanic. You know, Criminal actually had a lot of iterations in playtesting. There's a previous mechanic called Plan that we won't talk about, but it was not
very
good.
Holy fuck. Oh, I'm sorry. I just totally... Yeah, Plan was awful. Fuck.
Yeah, so, plan. You know, for however good you might think Borealis is, player and listener of the podcast, it went through its own iteration cycle, and not every idea I have is great, and it takes time to hash that out, and requires a lot of support from everyone in Nisei to make great shit. So regardless, so there's like a bad wit, criminal mechanic, and then the next pitch was this kind of like idea of the runner having a kind of fleeting attention span, or like, I don't know, there was something going on here, and we thought this like roll a d6 mechanic was cool because you could sort of stack the odds in interesting ways, such that like a skilled player could take advantage of good or bad dice rolls, was the idea.
Yeah.
And eventually it got crafted into the mechanic mark. But the important thing about that journey is the only difference between the last version of the roll a d6 mechanic and mark is that we stopped saying roll a d6. That's the only difference between the last version of the mechanic and mark. And I think the cool thing about that is internally, the feedback we got in playtesting was like, rolling d6 is stupid. This is randomness. You're ruining Netrunner. Like, Netrunner is just being about rolling dice. It's not really Netrunner. It's this bullshit game that we're playing now, and it's not fun, and everyone's going to hate it, and this is bad. And then we rewrote it, so it just said, instead of roll a d6, it said, choose a server randomly. And then everyone was like, oh, actually, this is great.
Yeah, so funny. I've heard so many arguments that were like, listen, like, this isn't what Netrunner is about. We don't roll. This isn't Hearthstone. We don't want randomness in our game. I was one of those people. I was like, fucking dice. Are you joking? I own 8 dice, but I don't want to have to roll them. That's authoritarianism. And so, yeah, it was really funny because it got changed to become a random central server. Like, everyone was like, oh yeah, this is Netrunner. And we just rolled the dice.
Yeah, and now, of course, all the physical playtesting I do, I just roll a dice to determine the server. Like, 1 and 2 is archives, you know, 3 is R&D, 5 and 6 is HQ. I do it every time I play with the mechanic in person. And it's literally the same. It's not different at all. But it feels so much better because of its presentation and the context it lives in. So, yeah, that's like kind of the funny thing about this mechanic is the big design lesson here was like, how you present a mechanic to people is almost more important than what the mechanic actually is. And like Mark having a component of randomness when framed as rolling a d6 is very emotionally loaded, but when framed as choose a random server is cool and everyone thinks it's neat, which is hilarious and very interesting.
It was really interesting to me because it's like, yeah, I won't talk about plan because plan was rough, but we did plan and plan didn't work out and dev and design was like, okay, we're gonna start over. I think Mark really turned out well. I think Mark's one of the big successes of Midnight Sun and Boyalis because it's like, it started rough, but it's actually a lot of fun. And Sable's a lot of fun. And it's really funny watching the criminal player get tilted when they like roll archives like 5 times in a row. Like it's a very rewarding experience as a core player.
It's funny how different mechanics shape up over the course of a playtesting cycle, but Mark, I think in general, is a really good example of how you can really find a compelling idea and iterate on it and tune it down to like a really cool mechanic. And I think I also agree it turned out really well.
Are there any other cards in the set where you had to trick players into having fun?
Oh, I always trick people into having fun. That's my job. Like, unironically, it's basically my job because it's like, you have to sort of like this is the thing. Everyone is going to have like a range of emotional responses to the literal words printed on the cards. And all that like entire bubbling pot of different emotional responses to all the things you make has to like somehow add up to like compelling gameplay. So I think, you know, a lot of being a game designer is like effective emotional manipulation, you know, and that's like true of being like an entertainer though. Like if you go to a comedy show, you're like, here's $20, make me laugh, right? Like that's the premise of it. Manipulate my emotions into laughing. That is what I want from you. And I think as a game designer, I think about it the same way where it's like, okay, here's my $50. Now manipulate me into having fun, right? I'm here to have a good time. Make me have that good time. So yes, short answer, yes. But there's many areas where game design, where the, like, I think keywords are a good example of things that people were resistant to, but then they see it in action and they're like, oh, this is really cool. I like this, you know?
I think, you know, the story of Midnight Sun, for me at least, is Netrunner can be something a little different and that's okay, you know?
Yeah, that's what I think too.
And it's really, I think it's a very human response is like, I try to be really open-minded, but like when I hear, I'm going to get fucking put in Nisa jail for this one. So you may have to censor this, Phil. But it's like, we'll probably do an episode on this, but the core damage change, used to be called Great Damage, now it's called Core Damage Change happened. And when that was announced internally, I was like, this is fucking stupid. I'm going to still call it Brain Damage. Like, this is really dumb. Why are they changing this? And now I call it Core Damage now, and it's like, I feel fine about it. And I think there's this natural human response to be like, change is bad because it is. But in reality, I think Netrunner is better for having like these mechanics and keywords and stuff like that.
I'm so excited for this Core Damage reveal. I'm just picturing myself at work, not doing work, but reading the fucking salt on Reddit about it. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. The salt. Looking forward to it.
I have absolutely no comment on Core Damage. I will say this. The vast, vast, vast majority of companies and studios, which is to say none of them, have people who are passionate about the idea of inclusivity and diversity on the level that Nisei has. Like, I've worked at massive companies, and there's like an inclusivity coordinator, and like, do they actually do anything? And the answer is fucking no, because companies do what makes money, yeah. Right? That's what companies do. Nisei is in a unique position that we have people who are passionate and care about this issue enough that they're willing to make difficult choices and changes for what they think is the betterment of the game product and the betterment of the players in the community. And even if that brings on some salt and some criticism, like all changes do, and I expect there to be angry Reddit threads about keywords, like fully expect it. I fully expect people to be like, this isn't Magic the Gathering. I hate Nisei now forever. Goodbye. Like, I expect that, right? Like, and I think that is an indication of a good change because it means that, like, you know, it's hard to say that negative feedback is an indication of a good choice. But the reality is that if people were ambivalent about it, that would be worse than if people are passionate about it either way. And, you know, I'm sure Core Damage will have big defenders and big detractors, and I'm sure keywords will have big defenders and big detractors. But as an organization, the thing that I think really warms me to core damage and to things the EDI team recommends is that Nisei is uniquely positioned that our EDI team has actual power. The EDI people at big companies have no power. They can't actually make things better because making things better costs capitalists money. At Nisei, the EDI team can make changes because it's in their view and their assessment and their research and their very long hours thinking these problems through for the betterment of the game. And I think that even if you don't agree with the change at the end of the day, even if you prefer, you know, brain damage, it's still worthy of our respect and our admiration that people care enough about both Netrunner and the issue of inclusivity and diversity to actually be able to have this team and have these people working on these things. So that's what I'll say about it. You know, I feel like, if nothing else, you know, I feel very fortunate to be on a team that even has that, because I've worked in the games industry for almost a decade and I've never seen anything like the core damage change. But the reality is that's because most game studios don't really care. Mm-hmm. And Nisei actually gives a shit. So people are willing to make changes.
I think no matter what, I trust that Slack will have an even-keeled, level-headed discussion about language and ableism when this topic comes up. I'm sure it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
My heart hurts now.
But let's talk about that card that we completely skipped over.
Oh, yeah.
I feel so, like, you know, the tough part about giving us scoops is we never really talk about them that much.
We don't really talk about Netrunner that much. But no, I like it. It reminds me right off the bat of Hive, which was in one of the first cycles. Forgotten second cycle, I think, now. Yeah. But yeah, it starts off strong. Huge pain in the ass to break, except for Paperclip, which is just the same every time. But yeah, and it just gradually gets weaker. And then now you have something to do with it when it does get kind of crap. Although 5 strength, 1 sub is still not bad.
I think this is one of those weird ice. So, like, the big thing for me is this ice gets you border control.
Oh, right, because it's at 5. Yep.
Yeah. I think that this ice is probably not great right now because of Paperclip, but Paperclip rotates when the set after Boyas comes out. I don't know if that name has been spoiled yet.
Is it? Yes, maybe. I think Bell Tower is the...
Yeah,
the
okay, yeah, yeah. Paperclip will rotate when Bell Tower comes out. So in a world without Paperclip, this ice looks a lot better.
Absolutely.
I think it's fine. I think it's going to be better in startup and other low power formats. Like, it's not going to be great in standard, but yeah. I think it's a cool ice. I mean, I think like tutoring for a 4-cost ice or 4-cost cut is going to be really cool. Yeah. And
did
that's all
our start scores. With 10 power counters, June?
It's not a Shaper card, so it didn't.
Oh, okay.
If it was a Shaper card, it started with a 10 somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, this is... I'm excited. I like these Wayland cards a lot. What do you think, Phil?
I really love it. I mean, especially with the ID, it's just... I mean, it's that trade-off of, yeah, trashing your own cards, weakening yourself, but doing something that will ultimately get you ahead. That's such like an interesting trade-off to me, and I can't wait to play around with it.
Are you going to be a Worlds June?
I will be, yeah.
It's exciting. I think I'm going to try. I'm going to really try and make it, I think. So I hope to see
you. I'm very excited. I wanted to go to Worlds. I mean, you know, joining Nisei, it's like, fuck. I want to see my people.
Yeah, because it's all online, eh?
Yeah, it's like all online. It's like I really haven't had an opportunity to meet people in person other than at PAX. And I think, you know, I don't know, maybe this sounds like an egomaniac, but one of the things I really like about being a game designer on games with cool communities is interacting with the community and, like, I don't know, at people asking questions and coming up to me.
You
want to
crowd surf.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's like, and not only that, but I actually think that, like, when you're doing the job of lead game designer well, you are giving people hope and excitement for the future of the game. And I think that is something that Netrunner has not always had. And I think it's one of the big successes of games like Magic, where I think Gavin and Mark and the people who talk about Magic over at WotC, they do a really good job being evangelists for what is so cool about Magic. And I think that is like a really cool part of being the lead designer, is you get to be an evangelist for why Netrunner is the best game ever. And people want to, as it turns out, the people at Worlds probably want to talk about why Netrunner is the best game ever. So
I think you'll get a lot of beers bought for you and like a lot of signatures. Like, you're like kind of, I feel like you're kind of like a Netrunner rockstar at this point. Like,
I hope everyone
thinks you're cool.
Rockstar, but like, I think I'm just willing to be myself on podcasts for better or for worse. But, you know, I definitely am just excited to see fans of the game. I'm excited to see old friends and, like, you know, I'm excited for Eric to not have to buy a cab from the airport to my apartment and end up in San Francisco instead of Oakland ever again.
I tell that story all the time. Like,
yeah, both in the U.S., how far could they be?
Yeah, the thing is that Eric thought that Oakland was a neighborhood of San Francisco and took a cab to downtown San Francisco instead of to my house in Oakland, California, which is like 10 miles across the Bay Bridge from downtown San Francisco, because to Eric's mind, I lived in San Francisco in the neighborhood Oakland. So easy mistake to make, but not quite accurate.
That Eric. Are you playing Netrunner in LA right now?
I am, yeah. I went to the circuit opener. It was great. I went 4-4 like a good game designer.
Nice.
Showing that I know how to play the game, but I'm ultimately mediocre at it.
It's a good retirement style position to be in. You know, good enough to like put people in their place, but bad enough to, like, you don't look like a show off.
Yeah. I'm not like the lead designer and I'm winning tournaments. Like, I think that's a bad look. I actually now only play like kind of meme-y decks. Like, I pretty much only play Shaper because Shaper is my favorite faction. Yeah. Even if they're terrible, I just play Shaper. Like, you know those, like, I feel like competitive players make fun of those people. Like, oh yeah, they just always play PE. That person's weird. Like, they don't care about winning. They care about playing PE. That's who I am now. You know, like, back in the competitive days, it was like, yeah, you got to play the best deck. You got to play the thing that gives you the highest percentage points in winning the tournament. And now it's like, no, I just want to play, like, Shaper and, like, a cool deck with tags in it. That'd be good.
Yeah. It's like die here or live long enough to see yourself become the
villain. Yeah, exactly. Now I'm just the thing I always thought I'd never be.
I mean, I kind of feel like it's interesting because it's like, I feel like I'm turning into like a Netrunner casual June, and it's a really weird process where, like, in my head, I'm like, okay, the only two decks in existence are PD and Max. But I was thinking of going to a tournament in a few weeks and being like, oh, what if I just played like Ezmari for fun? And like,
yes.
playing Netrunner for fun is such a fucking foreign concept to me.
I think you're becoming an adult, Eric.
Join us.
I think you're becoming someone who thinks life is about more than just winning. It's about like fulfillment and enjoyment and community. And when you realize that, then maybe you do play Ezmari for fun. You know,
it's tough. Yeah, I think Worlds is going to be good. Yeah, it's going to be good. I think Midnight Sun is going to be good. You know, like, I think the set's lit. You know, I mean, like, I wouldn't be such an like, I've been an optimist. I've also fucking morphed into somehow a Nisei defender over the last year.
Yeah,
I keep standing up for them because the fucking product's good and the teams are good and the people are good. You know, so it's like the Midnight's. Finally, I can like. I've tried not to, like, in public be too much of, like, oh, Midnight Sun's really, really good. You're all going to love it. But I've really felt that way for a long time. And so now that it's, like, out in public, I'm excited that I'm going to be able to celebrate with people. Because I don't want to do the playtester thing of being like, oh, this thing that's not coming out for a while is really good. You're going to love it. Like, I think that's kind of shitty. So I haven't said that. But now that it's actually coming out, I can celebrate with people and be like, oh, this thing's going to be so fucking lit.
I'm really excited to play all these. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so many more to come.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how do you pronounce the second half of the cycle?
Parhelion.
Parhelion. What is it? What is a parhelion?
I don't know.
A parhelion is also called a sun dog, and it's when the sun has like these little, not quite a whole halo ring, but it's just got two blobbies of light on the side of it. Happens a lot in Canada. You probably see it.
Is that like a moisture effect in the air?
I think it's like ice crystals in the air. So kinda, yeah.
Cool.
Do you have to go, June, or do you have time for Canadian Politics Corner?
I have time for Canadian Politics Corner. I don't know anything about Canadian politics.
Well, you're about to find out.
I'm excited.
This is probably going to ask questions, because, or you can do the thing every American guest does whenever we talk about Canadian politics, which is just sit in silence.
Say nothing.
No, American politics are really tragic and sad, and I'm down to talk about Canadian politics.
It's also tragic and sad, don't worry.
Okay, good. I'm excited then.
Phil,
mm-hmm.
Did you hear the thing about the convoy people in Parliament last week?
No, are they back in Ottawa?
Oh my fucking lord, dude. Okay, so there was a House committee meeting on. So like, we talk about this every fucking week on Canadian Politics Corner. There was a convoy, some light fascism, you know, fascism Canadian edition.
Yeah,
they've all been like dispersed to the winds. The Conservatives fucking invited a bunch of convoy people into the fucking Parliament building to like testify on like
terrorists. Oh.
Dude, this guy, it's like one of these guys is like a soldier who's like wanted for arrest because he spoke out against the COVID-19 vaccine while he was in uniform. And if you watch the testimony, it's insane because it's like you got like a bunch of top convoy people in fucking parliament in committee talking about how the vaccine isn't real and shit. It's wild shit.
Is convoy a term? You're like AKK in Canada?
No. Okay, well, kind of. So like
similar.
Okay. Here's what happened. In like January, basically they changed the rules at the border about whether you could basically they said, okay, hey truckers, you have to be vaccinated to go into the US and come back. Basic shit.
Reciprocal agreement between countries.
Yeah. The truckers, and not all of the truckers, a small minority of truckers were like, this is bullshit. We're going to like do like a freedom convoy across the country to Ottawa to protest in Ottawa. Ottawa is the capital of Canada.
So the convoy is the truckers. It's not like an...
Okay. Well, I mean, they claim to be truckers, but there's like a few trucks. Really,
there's a few trucks. And then a bunch of fascists who are like tagging along.
Exactly. Yeah
it's like funded by like dark money from the US and shit. Like, it's like a big fascism conference on this. And they just like, they basically blockade the parliament building. They honk the horns all through Ottawa. They start blockading ports of entry. I think that's called the Friendship Bridge between Windsor and Detroit. And they start like blockading shit in Alberta. And it's a real bad look because the police won't do anything. And then when the blockades get broken up, like in Alberta, there's this video of like the blockades get broken up and like, these are fucking domestic terrorists, but they're getting hugged by the RCMP,
yeah.
Which is like our national racism police. So it's a bad look, you know?
So, and, like, the police don't do anything because police are also fascists.
Correct? Yeah, yeah. It's like
fascists are just having a good time.
Yeah. It was a big fascist. It's like one of those things where it's like they really said the quiet part out loud. Because it's like, whenever fucking indigenous people in this country protest, they're bringing out the sticks and the guns right away. But, like, when white people, like, white conservatives protest or whatever, it's just like, oh, that's just them exercising their freedoms. Like, it's the whole fucking meal deal. And This is, like, a big national shame. We're just like, this is so fucked. And it went on for like a month and a half.
Way too long, yeah.
And the national...
A month and a half of this?
Yeah. It was bad. And like, the National Emergencies Act was invoked because the provinces wouldn't do anything.
The police wouldn't do anything. Like, municipalities couldn't force the police forces to actually act on anything. So yeah, the federal government had to enact a federal policy on emergencies.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like when the Proud Boys show up and like, in, do you know what the Proud Boys are in America?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they come from Canada. Don't worry.
This is like when the Proud Boys show up to like, quote unquote, counter protest and the police are all like facing in the direction of the anti-fascist protesters and like protecting the Proud Boys kind of thing.
100%.
100%. It was real bad. Especially because like 80% of the Canadian identity is believing that you're better than the Americans. And so when you have an event that like makes you look just as bad as the Americans, it's like the Canadian psyche can't handle that, you know? It's like completely disassociate.
It was so really crushing, yeah.
Yeah, it's like we just lost a national identity for a while. And then like last week they just fucking started interviewing these people in the parliament building asking them for their opinions on like the vaccine, which is insane shit to me. The Conservative Party invited, and then we have the Conservative Party in Canada, which is kind of like really like right for us, but like left of your Democrats,
and but they're still anti-vaccine.
Oh yeah.
Well, they gotta cater to the crazy.
Well, they're not anti-vaccine. They're like pro freedom of choice. You know what I mean? Like they're not coming out and being like, oh, the vaccine's bad. They're just like, we think people should have the right to choose whether they want to get vaccinated or not. Which is it's all like code for like we are anti-vaccine because the conservatives in this country have to pretend that they're like in the center.
They can't stray too far or they lose the suburb dads like me, you know?
The players who have podcasts and children.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big demographic for conservatives.
You know, actually, something unrelated to Canadian politics, but I was thinking about the other day, a lot of people in Nisei have kids or are having kids or whatever. And I think about this where I'm like, remember when, I don't know if anyone had this experience, when I was a kid, my parents had like hobbies, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you guys are fucking lame, right? Like,
that's us. Don't worry.
I just remember being like, my dad like showing off his motorcycle to his friends who all build motorcycles. I'm like, you guys are fucking stupid. Why don't you jump ramps or some cool shit? You know, like, what are you out here doing? And then now I'm 33 and I'm fucking running like the design of this like Nisei thing. And I got other hobbies. I like roller skating. I don't know. And then it's just like, I'm just like my parents. If I had kids right now, they'd be like, oh, my parents are fucking lame. They like cards and roller skating or whatever. It's the same thing. It's a vicious cycle.
It is.
Yeah, that's.
No, whenever I tell my son that playing Netrunner is not just like throwing the cards on the floor, he's like, no, that's not cool.
How old is your son now?
4.
Oh, so you've taught him how to play Netrunner.
I'm trying, but you know, he has a different vision for the game. Maybe June will make that a reality. It's more of a dexterity thing.
Yeah, we got to do like a dexterity version of Netrunner. Yeah, that, I don't think the EDI team will have any problem with the dexterity version of Netrunner.
Probably not.
Well, yeah, I'll say it. Number one reason mechanics die on the cutting room floor is like this has too much like object manipulation. There's too much like counters and moving cards and looking at cards and like there's just too much going on with this. It's like kind of hard to do small object manipulation issues. That's like a big reason. Like really adventurous stuff gets cut because it's just like kind of too much physical labor to perform it.
We already have a dexterity skill card in Netrunner. It's called Museum of History.
Yeah, I remember that. That's actually like I think from that would be like an EDI no-go.
Museum. I had to go through a period of mourning to come to that position, but I also kind of agree.
Yeah, but I think that's an example of something that is in Nisei that like Nisei would never print Museum of History because shuffling is something that is easier for some players and harder for others for a variety of reasons and has accessibility issues, so we just wouldn't make the card.
And I appreciate that, because look, I got all my fingers, but oh man, I'm clumsy as hell.
Yeah, for
sure. But do you think that you'll ever design a Netrunner set for kids?
I think if that day came, it would be pretty unreal. Like, it would be, like, a pretty, like, far-flung future where, like, Netrunner had, like, a large enough audience that we were, that growth, the only way to, like, grow more was to get the kids hooked on it. And then it's, like, what world is that? Is it, like, we're just GameNet? Is that it? Like, that's where we're at? Nisei becomes GameNet? That completes the arc? I don't know.
You can think of, like, accept it in time. That's fine.
What about, like, a card game version of, like, Jewels?
Fuck yeah.
Well, I think that's the Nisei stance on smoking. So, thank you so much for coming on, June.
Yeah, no problem. I had a really good time.
June, are you in like something like a communist punk folk band we can exit on a song of?
No, I'm not. Most of the stuff I'm into outside of Nisei is roller skating and not safe for work stuff. So, you know, just leave it at that. So I kind of just like, yeah, I don't have a sweet communist punk band, unfortunately. I don't have anything that would be sweet to plug. Just, you know, play Netrunner. It's sweet. If you really hate it, you can tell me it's my fault. If you really love it, I'll point to someone else on Nisei who actually did it, who wasn't me.
Sounds good. So, yeah, go roller skating, find June, and I think that'll do it.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. See you around.
Enjoy the rest of Spoiler Scoop season.
That was a good episode, yeah. I had fun.
It was good.
That was a good mix of serious interviewing and shitposting.